Tuesday, EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2% with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas-dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had 5 stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable. regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the Bold Escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the crisis escalates between Russia and Ukraine, it's the role of the media that's become increasingly crucial. In Britain's parliament, the leader of the opposition Labour Party waded into the discussion with a controversial position.
Russia today is his personal propaganda tool. Yeah. I can see no reason why it should be allowed to continue to broadcast in this country. So will the Prime Minister now ask Ofcom to review its licence?
Mr Speaker, I believe that my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, has already asked Ofcom to review that matter.
It's not the first time RT has been targeted, but long gone are the days of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn appearing on the channel. Starmer is keen to stake his anti-Russian credentials. Russia and the West are both acutely aware that the media battle is as important as any armed conflict. And by attempting to silence Russian media here in the United Kingdom, the British establishment is simply continuing a long-held tradition of censorship. Political observers disagree with Starmer's stance.
It's totalitarian surveillance capitalism, essentially, which is continuing its ugly march through the West. I mean, where we actually prided ourselves in not being so censored, we're now at the stage where we're controlling media at that point. Of course, I know Press TV were victims of exactly this. There have been many people across social media who are constantly being censored. And I think it's a very dangerous development. And when it's normalized to the extent where, the major party leaders, the prime minister, are all acting as if it's a perfectly normal thing to do, it's a very dangerous and dark day for democracy.
Though it's not publicly commented on whether there will be a probe, Ofcom's impartiality has already come under scrutiny, and observers are urging caution and for the organization to abide by media rules, not political pressure.
It is always good to hear the other side of an argument anyway and an alternative narrative, so you can see and make a balanced judgment of what is going on, because we know from the Iraq war and the propaganda about WMD that our own government doesn't necessarily tell the truth when it goes to broadcast either. These are very troubled times, and the last thing we need is censorship of our television viewing.
As calls ring out for calm heads and a de-escalation to prevail in the current crisis, media observers hope the people at home and abroad can have a plurality of media voices, this to help shape their views. Amina Taylor, London.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The recent revelations about the Trojan Horse scandal, a hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools, highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and how victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedburgh. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford, who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Masoud Shajari, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing, to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter, and everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. You know, when you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajet. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, you know, they just believed it. And, of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme, while the education budgets were creaking along and you know, not able to perform. So there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajara, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, and we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm, and we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. And the problem is this, that, you know, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. Every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button, and we forget about everything that has happened in past, and we're forgetting that we are living in this environment, and then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. And we need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister and two. And I think, you know, Ivan knows this very well. I remember, Ivan, you raised that once in a meeting you were to one of the very senior police officer. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up with the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up, not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such such affair, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America, because it should have come from the British media. But unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic. And, you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. I'm not, you know, they got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. You know, we have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajadeh, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. No, you know, they're promoting Islamophobia in many ways. The fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, you know, even when it breaks out, you know, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, you know, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And you know, shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And you know, now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January, on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bullying.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
McChrystal's new book is so stuffed with mendacity and banality that it serves as an expose on America's generals after 9/11, says Peter Moss, writer, in an article published under the heading, Stanley McChrystal accidentally reveals the dishonesty of U.S. generals. Stay tuned for more. It is time to make a strange addition to the short list of essential documents on the dishonesty of America's generals. A new book from retired General Stanley McChrystal titled Risk, A User's Guide. McChrystal was removed from his command by President Barack Obama, but afterward created a thriving consulting firm and often appears on TV to talk about war and politics. His notebook is intended to be a primer for corporate leaders trying to navigate the perils of doing business in America. The conceit is straightforward. Hello, I am a retired four-star general who bravely led troops into the battle. And I can tell you everything you need to know about managing risk. There is a lot that McChrystal might teach us, because he was responsible for a series of consequential errors from which valuable lessons could be learned. Those errors include the concoction of a plan in 2009 to defeat the Taliban insurgency by flooding Afghanistan with as many as 80,000 additional U.S. troops. This was the kind of troops and money strategy that succeeded mainly in killing lots of civilians and helping the Taliban return to power.
On a less catastrophic scale, McChrystal actively participated in the cover-up of the friendly fire killing of NFL player turned true Pat Tillman, whose 2004 death the Pentagon initially blamed on Taliban, knowing that this wasn't true. McChrystal also took the ill-advised risk of allowing a Rolling Stone reporter to embed with his entourage on a trip around Europe. And the resulting article, which conveyed the general's disdain for America's elected leaders, led to his early retirement in 2010. The book Risk is stuffed with so many displays of dishonesty, ignorance, and banality that it's the ultimate self-own for a generation of generals who led America into disaster after 9/11 and profited from it. With his new book, McChrystal turns himself into an accidental whistleblower. There is a basic question to ask before buying a general's advice book. Why are we listening to this guy? America treats its generals as revered proxies for its ordinary troops, loving them even though the wars they have presided over have been catastrophic. There has been more than $14 trillion in defense spending since 9/11, more than 7,000 U.S. troops dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at least several hundred thousand civilians killed, which is a conservative estimate. Throughout these calamities, the generals lied about what was happening, telling Congress and the American public that things were going well when they knew it wasn't true. The breathtaking scale of their deceit was revealed in classified documents that the Washington Post published in an award-winning 2019 series titled A War with the Truth. Their failures have occurred outside the battlefield, too. One of the most venerated generals of recent times is James Mattis, who commanded U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and went on to become President Donald Trump's first war secretary. Before joining the Trump administration, Mattis was on the board of directors of Theranos to provide advice on building elite teams. He received an annual stipend of $150,000 and continued to defend Theranos even after the Wall Street Journal revealed in 2015 that the company's blood testing machines were fraudulent. Testifying in September at the trial of the company's founder, Elizabeth Holmes, Mattis is avidly through her under the bus, saying that he was disappointed at the level of transparency from Ms. Holmes. A different type of flame-out happened to retired General David Petraeus, another famous commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, who served as Obama's director of the CIA. Petraeus didn't last long at Langley because he was having an affair with his biographer and shared classified information with her. The tradecraft he employed to covertly communicate with her was amateurish. They used a draft folder in a shared Gmail account, and while in Afghanistan, his military aides were excluded from helicopter trips so that his secret partner could ride along. Petraeus resigned from the CIA and pleaded guilty to mishandling classified information, but he's still respected and has a lucrative partnership at KKR, a private equity firm. One more item from the annals of generals gone bad. There is retired General Michael Flynn, who headed the Defense Intelligence Agency and briefly served as Trump's national security advisor until it was realized that he had deceived Vice President Mike Pence about his contacts with a diplomat. After pleading guilty to lying to the FBI, Flynn became a star of QAnon conspiracy crowd and called for America to have one religion, no prizes for guessing which one.
His leap into the world of Unhinged is not unique. Retired Brigadier General Donald Bullock, who served 10 tours in Afghanistan and led Special Operations Command Africa, is a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire and has described the state's governor, also a Republican, as a sympathizer. You get the point. Putting aside the conspiracy theories, corporate frauds, and the sharing of classified documents with persons not authorized to receive them, there is little evidence that the experience gained by generals translates into business acumen. In fact, there is evidence that companies with military officers on their boards have worse outcomes than their competitors. It's hard to imagine two cultures more different. In the military, a general can order the court-martial of a subordinate for disobeying orders. In the corporate world, Elon Musk is powerful, but he can't send lazy workers to prison. The skills used to organize a sales team for another round of cold calls are not what you need to lead Delta Force operations in tomorrow and mortal combat. Unless we forget, the U.S. military has a culture of sexual assault and harassment that has resisted decades of reform efforts. McChrystal appears to have the distinction of making more money from his military service than any U.S. general of his generation. According to a recent investigation by the Washington Post, McChrystal has served as a board member or advisor to at least 10 companies since leaving the military. He was paid more than $1 million for serving on the board of just one firm, Navistar International, which also paid $50 million to the government to settle accusations that it fraudulently overcharged the Marine Corps for armored vehicles. McChrystal also drew $70,000 for a single speech at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and $50,000 for an engagement at California Polytechnic State University. Both are public institutions not known to be awash with funds. The engine of McChrystal's business endeavors is his eponymous McChrystal Group, which has more than 50 employees and provides consulting services to corporate and government clients. While the book Risk is written in the first person, McChrystal has a co-author, Anna Butrico, who is an associate at his firm. References to the firm are scattered throughout the book, and its acknowledgement section gives credit to about a dozen employees who provided ideas and assistance. The book is prominently featured on the website of McChrystal Group. The book is dishonest because it ignores or distorts the risks undertaken by McChrystal that failed. This includes the Tillman episode, but most crucially, the disastrous war strategies in Afghanistan and Iraq. While there are boastful passages about military missions in Iraq that are portrayed as successful, special forces would identify and engage enemy fighters with a stunning speed, McChrystal claims. The abundant errors made there are basically unmentioned. More to the point, the handful of pages about Afghanistan skate past colossal failures in which McChrystal was deeply complicit. Violent raids by forces under his command are described only as creating extraordinary political controversy because they were antithetical to the Afghan culture. Nowhere does McChrystal admit the actual reason for the controversy. U.S. and Afghan forces killed an unconscionable number of civilians, and in some instances, the violence constituted war crimes.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.